Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Spring of Sustainability, a production of the Shift Network and the Sustainable World Coalition. I'm Ken White, the Associate Director of Post-Carbon Institute, and I'm so glad to have the opportunity for you to join us today and to be in conversation with our special guest, who is Richard Heinberg. And Richard's here to talk about our energy reality. Richard is a senior fellow of the Post-Carbon Institute and is widely regarded as one of the world's foremost peak oil educators. He's the author of 11 books now, including his most recent, which is called Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. And we'll talk a little bit more about that during our conversation. Richard's also written about the end of growth, adapting to our new economic reality, as well as peak everything, waking up in the century of decline. Which is also somewhat of a multimedia phenomena, and his animation, 300 Years of Fossil Fuels in 300 Seconds, won the YouTube Do-Gooder Video of the Year Award in 2011 and has been viewed by more than 1.5 million people. You can learn more about Richard Heinberg and his work at postcarbon.org or resilience.org or richardheinberg.com. Richard, it's a great pleasure to have you with us today. Welcome.
Thank you, Ken. Good to be talking with you.
Well, some people might think it's a little funny for someone who works in the same organization as you to be interviewing you, and I've had the privilege of working with you for nearly 5 years now, but I've never had the privilege of asking you some questions that we might cover today. So I'm excited about this opportunity. So thank you for the opportunity to engage with you.
Oh, great. I look forward to it, too.
Good. I think one thing I'd like to start out with is this week's programming on Spring of Sustainability is all about what we're calling our energy reality. So what is our energy reality, and what's the single most important thing that people concerned about sustainability should know about our energy reality?
Well, the first thing people have to understand is that energy is really, really important, and it's something we tend to take for granted. But it shouldn't be taken for granted at all. It basically is what makes the world work. If we have lots of cheap energy available, that enables us to do lots of things. And that was basically the situation we found ourselves in the 20th century as a result of having cheap oil, coal, and natural gas available to us. We were able to do things that people had never done before. Sure, it took technological innovation. It required, the building of new technology systems like highways and airports and so on. But, you know, at the end of the 20th century, we were flying around the world in aluminum cans and thinking nothing about it. And, you know, people a century previous to that would have thought of that as a miracle. The economy has expanded dramatically in recent decades, and that's mostly a result of our burning more fossil fuels and having more energy available. Another aspect of energy reality that we need to understand is that all energy production and consumption has environmental costs. And there are different environmental costs. Obviously, with fossil fuels, one of those costs is climate change. But there are others as well, including ocean acidification and various forms of water and air pollution, and then the results of that pollution in human health and the health of ecosystems and wildlife. But even with renewable energy systems, there are costs. It's true that sunlight is free and abundant and in itself is, you know, great. But the technology that we use to capture sunlight, you know, those solar panels have to be built out of something and transported and so on. And all of that entails environmental costs. Same things with wind turbines and you name it. So there's no free lunch in nature. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be harvesting economy from our environment. Obviously, we have to in order to live, and we're going to. But we need to be aware of what those costs are. And at the end of the day, if we're going to have a habitable environment, we have to aim for an economy of a size that can be accommodated by the environment over the long term. And that means we have to accept that there are limits to the amount of energy that we can use. So those are, you know, the basic aspects of energy reality or energy literacy that we try to get across in our work. And the single most important energy reality, I think, that people need to understand today is that we are at the cusp of an energy transition that will change everything. Just as the Industrial Revolution, the fossil fuel revolution that took place over the last couple of centuries changed everything. About life, about how, you know, we organize ourselves in cities and how we spend our days, where our food comes from, you name it, all of that's been changed as a result of the fossil fuel revolution. Now we're at the cusp of an energy transition that's going to be just as important as that was, if not more so. Because as we change from fossil fuels to alternative energy sources and adjust to those new types of energy, it's not just going to be a plug and play situation where you unplug the coal power plant and plug in the solar panel and just keep doing what you were doing before. Every energy source has its own characteristics, and the characteristics of renewable energy sources are inherently different from those of fossil fuels. Society inevitably will adapt economically and in other ways to those differences, and it's going to change a lot about life. Some things we're going to like about those changes. The fact that our economies will be more locally organized, and we'll have a chance to get to know each other better and so on. But some things about those changes are maybe some of us won't like. The fact that, you know, air travel is almost entirely dependent on oil of all the fossil fuels, and there's no really good replacement for oil in terms of operating airplanes to keep, you know, millions of people flying around from continent to continent on a daily basis. That's that part of the energy transition may be more difficult to negotiate. But one way or another, a lot is going to change, whether we plan for it or not. But it'll go a lot better if we do plan for it.
Well, I think a lot of people in the sustainability field are thinking about it and planning for it, but perhaps maybe not in the ways that you've just outlined. So let me just pose an example. If we had, you know, roads that were paved with solar cells, and we had solar cells on every roof of every factory and every large building, and we had hydropower, we had micro hydropower, and we tapped into geothermal, and we had windmills wherever was appropriate, and we saved our fossil fuels for things like jet planes, and instead we're using electric to power, you know, public transit and cars. I mean, why couldn't we make an energy transition to something that looked sort of like today, but perhaps much more green and sustainable?
Right. Well, when you start to do the numbers on how much energy is actually likely to be available from alternative energy sources, and the characteristics of that energy, the fact that it's going to be largely intermittent and less controllable than fossil fuels, you start to come up with a different vision of how energy can be and should be used in that context. Less available on demand, and more, you know, we adjust our demand to when the energy is available. If we save our fossil fuels for running airplanes, yeah, that would extend their life, but we're talking about really, you know, maybe another few years or at the most another few decades. But even in the best case, that's going to be expensive jet fuel. And, you know, flying airplanes releases greenhouse gases at a higher rate per passenger mile than just about anything else we do. So one way or another, you know, that's a part of our current way of life that's going to pass away either sooner or later, and so we should be planning for that. Rather than building more airports and runways, we should be figuring out how to how to make our lives work, our economies work, without that particular feature of contemporary reality.
And I guess this is what you're talking about when you say energy literacy, is a deeper understanding that there's sort of no free lunch, and that we'll have to plan a future with less energy and less energy on demand as we've had right now.
Right. And, you know, you look at the trajectory of where we are right now in terms of renewable energy. We're going to have to ramp up the transition to a much faster rate of speed if we're going to accommodate the decline in fossil fuels as those deplete. That's going to have costs associated with it. And one of the characteristics of the alternative energy sources is that those costs mostly come up front. In other words, you pay for the solar panel up front, and then that cost is amortized over the 20 or 30 year lifetime of the solar panel. So that means that society is going to have to be investing an enormous amount over a short period of time in order to replace the energy from fossil fuels, which are more pay-as-you-go. That in itself is going to impose a certain kind of limit as to how much of a transition we can do. In other words, fossil fuels are going to go away, but how much of renewable energy infrastructure are we going to be able to build while we have the chance? And remember, right now, the building of that renewable energy infrastructure is on the back of our fossil fueled system. The way we manufacture solar panels and wind turbines and move them to the point of use, that's all currently funded by oil and other fossil fuels. We don't use solar electricity to make solar panels currently, and maybe that's feasible at some point. But right now, the whole renewable energy industry is acting effectively as a fossil fuel extender. As I say that, I'm not saying, you know, that it's not going to work, therefore we should throw up our hands and, you know, accept energy poverty in our future. But what I am saying is we're likely to have less energy as time goes on. It's not the end of the world. It doesn't mean we're going back to agrarian times. But it's going to be a different kind of energy, and we will have less available. So how can we create an acceptable, in fact, an exciting lifestyle under those circumstances? It can be done.
Yeah, before we get on to the changes in lifestyle, I just want to unpack a little bit of an irony in there. The irony is, as you point out, that in some ways renewable energy is extending the life of the fossil fuel economy, and the fossil fuel economy is needed in order to build the alternative energy sources that might power our future. The irony, of course, is that really is in some ways one of the drivers of climate change.
Right. Well, climate change is fundamentally driven by fossil fuel consumption, and we can remove some carbon from the atmosphere by sequestering it in soil if we're building soil through ecological agricultural practices, or we can store carbon in trees if we're planting, you know, hundreds of millions, billions more trees. But at the end of the day, dealing with climate change is really about reducing our fossil fuel consumption. So if we're reducing our fossil fuel consumption dramatically while we're also investing energy, and most of that will be fossil fuel energy, in building out an entirely new energy infrastructure based on renewables, well, something's got to give, and that's going to be our in many ways, it's going to be the growth economy, the consumer economy that we constructed during the 20th century in the context of cheap fossil energy.
You know, before we get down to the economics, just one more energy question. Someone said to me the other day, whatever happened to peak oil? You've been known for more than a decade as a longtime proponent and leading educator on the concept of peak oil. how has your understanding of peak oil evolved and unfolded, especially given that your recent book is about fracking?
Right. Well, you know, what we were saying back in the early days of the peak oil discussion was in some ways a little unformed and naive. We knew that there were limits to global oil supplies and that that would drive prices up. We didn't know exactly when the world would hit those limits. But, you know, when I go back and look at, for example, what I was writing in 2003 in my book, The Party's Over, I endorsed a position then that extraction of conventional oil would peak before 2010. And in fact, you know, if you subtract from current global oil production, the oil that's coming from unconventional sources like tight oil, which is what we're talking about when we're talking about fracking, or tar sands, or ultra-deep water oil, or Arctic oil, subtract all those unconventionals, and yep, conventional oil production did peak around 2005. It hasn't declined a whole lot since then, but it has declined. Our assumption then was that a peak in conventional oil production would lead to higher oil prices, and of course that's exactly what we've seen. Oil prices, which were in the, you know, $20 to $30 range in the time frame we're talking about, 2000 to 2003, are now in the $100 to $110 range globally. Nobody was predicting that back in those days in government or industry, but, you know, just these freak peak oil analysts were talking about it. It was pretty clear that higher oil prices would then spur increased production from the unconventional sources like tar sands, deep water, and all the rest. And, of course, we've seen that. So the only question remaining is when will unconventional production peak, like the what we're seeing in North Dakota and South Texas from the fracked and horizontally drilled fields there. Well, we've done that analysis at Post Carbon Institute. We've looked at over 63,000 currently producing fracked oil and gas wells. But just looking at the oil sector, it's pretty clear that in North Dakota, there's only one county that's still seeing increased production, McKenzie County. The rest of the counties in North Dakota are flat or declining already. And looking at the available drilling locations and looking at the rates of decline in existing wells, it's pretty clear that North Dakota as a whole is going to peak out probably 2015, 2016, maybe 2017, somewhere in that time frame. It depends on the rate of drilling. You know, if the drilling companies can come up with enough cash from Wall Street to, you know, really bear down on drilling more wells, then they could push that out a little bit, but not much. South Texas, the Eagle Ford play may be a little bit behind that. Another year or two further out. But we're not talking about decades and decades. This is a very short-term bubble. And once that bursts, then that's going to be, effectively, that's what's keeping global oil production at the level it is. Once U.S. tight oil production starts to go down, then global production goes down. There's a lot more detail to this. We could talk about the potential for fracking in other countries, other parts of the world. Our analysis suggests that's largely overrated or overstated. But, you know, when you get to the bottom line, the world oil industry, which is seeing higher and higher rates of investment for flat to declining rates of production, the global oil industry is in a state of clearly declining returns. And you know, it's an industry that's you know, gives all the public relations signs of being in a boom, but if you look at the fundamentals, if you look at the rising costs and falling revenues, this is an industry that's basically folding up shop.
So it seems like it's sort of a good news, bad news opportunity kind of thing. I mean, the good news is that all those resources that we keep hearing about, that we don't want to burn them, that we actually won't burn them. The other good news is that the fossil fuel companies have a really limited lifespan ahead of them. The bad news is that we're not quite ready for the transition to the kind of future we have, and maybe opportunity is that we've got a little window in which we can start making that transition, or at least get to work on as much of the transition as we can.
Right, yeah. Well, you know, higher oil prices have driven some good trends. Here in the United States, we're seeing declining vehicle miles driven. And this is the first time this has happened in decades. We're also seeing declining car ownership among young people in the key, you know, millennial demographic. Young people just don't see owning an automobile as their, you know, ticket to adulthood. They see it as a ball and chain, which increasingly it is. They want to be able to live their lives without having to be, you know, tied, handcuffed to an automobile. We're seeing a burgeoning localism movement, local food, local, you know, you name it. We're seeing falling prices in solar photovoltaics. Solar panels are getting cheaper. All of these trends are good, and they're all driving us in the right direction. The problem, as you say, you know, is we waited pretty late in the game to make this transition in a managed way. So there are parts of this energy transition that aren't going to be managed very well, unfortunately. It doesn't look like it anyway. I hope I'm wrong about that. So, you know, we have to do what we can with what we have. And much of that is going to be driven by personal behavior. You know, we're going to have to adapt as many people are. You know, I mentioned those trends with declining car ownership and vehicles miles driven. You know, as prices for fuels go up, we're going to be staying home more and walking more and bicycling more. And that will have some beneficial effects on our psychology, our communities, our sense of local culture, and so on. But it's not going to come without any cost whatsoever.
Richard, I just want to make sure our callers have the opportunity to ask questions. If you do have a question, just press 1 on your phone keypad, and we'll try and get those questions on. While folks are looking around for the number 1 on their keypad, it always confuses me. I've got a question for you that I'd like to pose to you because as someone who's really been in depth in this work for decades. What gives you hope? What inspires you, and what gets you out of bed in the morning?
Well, frankly, the resilience of the natural world and the beauty of the natural world are inspiring to me more than just about anything else. But that resilience and that beauty is also present in us as a species, and you know, human beings are capable of doing amazingly intelligent and just gorgeous things. My sort of avocation when I'm not doing energy work is playing the violin, and I have a tremendous love of music of all kinds, jazz, classical, and so on. And what some of our species have been able to do just in that area is just mind-boggling. So if we're capable of doing all of that, then, you know, we're capable of doing things even in under pressure. As you know, if you look back in the history of Western music, some of the most amazing music was written under historically really pretty depressing times. Well, you know, we're approaching a time that I think is going to be one of the more difficult times in human history. You know, as energy limits kick in, as the amount of energy available declines, that's going to have impacts on the economy. It's going to have impacts on our political systems, even the way we think about the world. You know, we tend to think everything's always going to be getting better. We're always going to have cooler new apps and technologies to use, and maybe we're approaching a period of time where, you know, instead of progress coming in that way, it's going to come more in terms of human relations and our ability to adapt to new environmental conditions. We can do that. Like I said, we're an amazing species, and I'm really eager to see what we come up with.
Yes, so am I. I certainly want to stick around to see what happens. To our listeners, if you press star 1, apparently, I may have misspoken, or you can enter, if you're on the Maestro website, you can enter a question in the chat window that appears on your screen. Want to make sure you have the opportunity to ask Richard anything that you've been dying to ask him. Actually, that last question is one that it leads to one that I've been dying to ask you. I remember hearing someone criticize the idea that we've come to think of innovation as always associated with technology, as opposed to innovation being a concept that humans can apply in a wide range of situations, everything from music and arts to philosophy to how we structure our relationships with others and live in community. And you mentioned earlier that we've come to think of human beings as always being able to innovate our way out of whatever problems we've gotten ourselves into. Where do you see the opportunities for innovation, given the problem we've gotten ourselves into with fossil fuels?
Right. Well, as you alluded to, I think social innovation is going to be a very important part of our process of adaptation. And when I look, for example, at what's happening with the transition town movement, there's a kind of social innovation. It doesn't solve everything, but my gosh, it puts a lot of people on a much better track, and it does so in a way that's not oppressive and authoritarian, but just the opposite. It's all grassroots and bottom up. It puts communities in charge of their own energy and climate and food adaptation processes. So folks who aren't familiar with transition, you know, check it out. Google transition towns, and you'll find an amazing array of information about what's going on in literally thousands of communities around the world right now.
And is this something that you see as something that will, one day sort of pop up? There'll be sort of a tipping point, or do you see this as sort of a gradual replacement for our existing ideas of technology and how we live in community and energy usage and those things?
Oh yes, there will definitely be tipping points. Back in 2008, not that long ago, the world was plunged into financial chaos and uncertainty, and immediately people began questioning things that previously were just, assumed. Facets of our economic system and consumerism and capitalism even and so on. Well, we're going to have moments like that as we go along, where whole systems that we take for granted are suddenly, no longer able to be taken for granted, and I think we'll have what could be called teaching moments or teachable moments in many different spheres. And so, let's get used to the idea and take advantage of those when they came along. I think the tragedy of 2008 was, of course, it was a lot of people suffered financially and in other ways as a result. But the other tragedy was that we didn't learn. We rushed to get back to normal, even if that meant maintaining the illusion of normalcy with things like quantitative easing and bailouts of otherwise defunct financial institutions. And all of that, of course, is just temporary. It's that those fixes will themselves come apart at a certain point. But rather than doing everything we can to maintain the appearance of business as usual, I think it's good that we use those teachable moments to really question some of the aspects of normalcy that we usually take for granted.
So if I'm torn between wanting to go to a rally against fossil fuels and wanting to go to a community garden building, I shouldn't see it as an either-or, but as a both-and. Both are good responses to the challenges of climate change and sustainability.
Absolutely. We're going to have to do a lot of both. The fight against fracking that's going on right now is a really important one, because this is a short-term strategy of the fossil fuel industry to remain viable, and it has enormous economic and human health and other implications that, you know, the only way to deal with those is to stop what's going on. And so efforts to do that are really important. But at the same time, you know, we got to build the alternative economy, the new economy. And in some ways that's happier work, but they both need to be done.
I just want to ask, Richard, if you can just stand for a moment longer. I realize we're right at time, but we did get a couple of questions in, and one of which seems very relevant to what you were just asking. What are the first steps to take for transitioning away from fossil fuels, both at a personal level and at a societal level?
Ooh, well, at a personal level, you know, a good first thing to do is just take stock of how much energy you're using and how. Most of us don't ever bother to do that. So looking at where you're using energy in your home and how much, and also your car, how much energy is embodied in the products that you're using, including the food you're eating. You may be shocked to learn, you know, how much energy and water go into producing, for example, a pound of beef versus a pound of grain. So do, obviously this is something that you could get really wonkish about and, you know, spend weeks and months doing it. And I know people who have, and it's been very instructive. But even if you do a relatively superficial energy audit of your life, it's going to really help you see where personal changes in energy consumption can have the most impact.
That's
a good place to start anyway.
And possibly a good place to stop as we're past the bottom of the hour. So let me remind our listeners, we've been talking with Richard Heinberg, a senior fellow at Post Carbon Institute at www.postcarbon.org and resilience.org. And this is part of the Spring of Sustainability series. You can find out more at springofsustainability.com/actions. And you'll find a sampling there of specific actions that are compiled from Richard and other people who are on this program, their suggestions. You can check a box next to each action item when you've completed it, and then the webpage will show you how many others have taken that action. And you'll see that we're having a cumulative impact with our individual actions, as well as Richard noted, importantly, our collective actions, both in our communities and with important issues like bringing the fossil fuel economy to its inevitable close. So thank you all for listening. Thank you, Richard, for your time and your good work, and thank you for the opportunity to finally ask you some questions.
Well, thank you, Ken. I've enjoyed it.
Okay, and to our listeners, be sure to join us for our next session and engage with us online at facebook.com/springofsustainability. Remember that if you'd like lifetime access to all of these sessions that you've been hearing through this 9-week program, there are 3 different upgrade packages available at the website, springofsustainability.com. And you can find those at the springofsustainability.com/upgrade page. So thank you again, Richard, for joining us, and thanks to everyone for joining us as well, and look forward to continued conversations.